Thanks for taking the time to download and listen to this podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady, and this is Andrew H. Smith.
Hi, and welcome to the Celtic Underground podcast, a special this week. I'd like love to welcome Matthew Marr. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi there, Andrew. How are we doing?
Not bad, not bad at all. And this is obviously birthday week for Celtic. So we're actually taking a kind of, we'll do our best to guide you through it, myself and Matthew, about the origins of Celtic and what were the motivations for those origins. Were Celtic, as we kind of, as the mythology goes, were they a charitable organisation, or were they really formed for charity, sole purpose for charity? Was there a religious element in there? Was it to do with the Irish Catholic immigrants who were suffering prejudice and injustice and poverty? Or was there a political element which has been picked up by the Green Brigade of more recent years, and it was certainly there? So all of those three elements, myself and Matthew are going to discuss that and see if we can really pick our way through. Matthew, just as a kind of opener, I mean, when I'm talking about that, I always see it as a kind of, if we're going to use a religious analogy, there's a kind of trinity. There's a three in one that we just discussed there, and I think competing motivations with the layman that Brother Walford brought in to really bring the club into being. But those three motivations are in there, and all the main figures that, for me, I don't know if you see it like that.
I think in simple terms, that is the reality. I mean, as a day job, I'm a teacher. And one of the funny things is that when pupils are younger, if you give them an essay question, you tend to say to them, look, even if there's three or four possible answers, that when you're younger and when you're still sort of developing and nuancing and all the rest of it, make one decision. So pick one as, for example, the most important cause of an event. Right. And obviously, the reality is, as they get older, you start to try and wean them off that slightly, in the sense you start to say to them, look, actually, obviously life is much more complex than that. And what you instead need to really be doing is nuance. The simple fact is you've identified the principal three factors that are undeniably that lie behind Celtic. You've clearly got the charitable aspect. There's massively a religious dynamic as well. And there is underlying that a sort of an Irish identity / Irish nationalism aspect. I think there's no question that all of them, to an extent, will play a role. I don't think it's an even percentage.
No.
But I do think that they are there. And I think, to some extent, sometimes the problem in this debate tends to be people, as is, I suppose, true in life generally, people's opinion on which is the biggest percentage tends to, strangely enough, align with their own. If they are particularly religious, then they think that's the dynamic. If they are very political, then they think that's the political thing. I think the honest reality is, though, that all three factors play a role. But I think, I think particularly two are significant, and they're actually very easy to point out, because you only have to look at the club's sort of founding statement to see a very, very clear thread of what was it envisaged and what was planned, basically.
So that's a neat segue there, Matthew, because I thought, if we're doing this, why don't we read out that, why don't we actually refer to that? Kind of call to arms. It was an original call to arms, wasn't it? Because they were looking, obviously, they'd had the meeting on the 6th of November, 1887. And then in January came this, their first major statement. And it, as you say, I think that first major statement tells us quite a lot, does it not? Hold on.
I've actually got it in front of me. I mean, I can actually...
I thought I had it in front of me, but no, go for it.
No, I mean, I don't know if you want me to read the whole thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's not that long.
From the very start, you can already clearly see a theme. So, I mean, for people that haven't seen the famous statement, so it has at the top, you know, it's just sort of basically the address, tells us as well where the original Celtic Park was, pointing out the corner of Dalmarnock and Janefield Street. But the actual, so the statement is very clear. His Grace, the Archbishop of Glasgow, and the clergy of St Mary's, Sacred Heart, and St Michael's Missions, and the principal Catholic laymen of the East End. The above club was formed in November 1887 by a number of Catholics in the East End of the city. The main object is to supply the East End conferences of the St Vincent de Paul Society with funds for the maintenance of the dinner tables of our needy children in the missions of St Mary's, Sacred Heart, and St Michael's. Many cases of sheer poverty are left unaided through lack of means. It is therefore with this principal object that we have set afloat the Celtic, and we invite you as one of our ever-ready friends to assist in putting our new park in proper working order for the coming season. We have several players of the leading Catholic footballers of the West of Scotland in our membership list. They have most thoughtfully offered to assist in the good work. We are fully aware that the elite of football players belong to this city and suburbs, and we know from there that we can select a team that can do credit to the Catholics of the West of Scotland, as Hibernian have done in the East. Again, there is a desire to have a large recreation ground where our Catholic young men will be able to enjoy the various sports, which will build them up physically, and we feel sure we will have many supporters with us in this laudable object.
Five mentions the word Catholic.
Yeah. I don't think there's any question. I mean, I think you've already instantly gone to it. I think if we were, to some extent, if you're actually going to ask a question, for example, you know, what's the most important cause? One of the key things that has to be done in history is setting the context, is setting the scene. Because I think often that plays a role in actually explaining why it came about, you know, or why a particular event happened. And I mean, I think there's different aspects that you can look at of where did Celtic's formation come from. But from a principal perspective, so if we work on the basis that, you know, Angortimor, the Irish potato famine, whatever we want to call it, has happened, there is now a major influx of particularly Irish into Glasgow. It is worth noting that, you know, the potato famine, it's wrong to call it the Irish potato famine because it wasn't simply Irish. You know, many people starved in Scotland as well. So it's not simply the Irish that are flocking into places like Glasgow, although that is clearly numerically the big one. In this era, you know, about one in five people in Glasgow were born in Ireland. So you have just absolutely massive levels of poverty. This is, of course, a Britain without a welfare state. You know, the government doesn't provide the sort of levels of support, even in modern era, that we would expect. You are forced to rely on potentially the poorhouse, you know, as sort of this horror of horrors. So there's no question that within that there is a context of absolute desperation. There's also, not simply in Glasgow, not simply to do with Celtic, there is a rise in the latter part of the 1800s of, you know, political campaigning movements. It's partly linked to the fact that working class men have now gained the right to vote. And it's also connected to a growing recognition amongst many people that are better off, not all, but that, you know, this is an abject, horrible aspect of poverty that something needs to be done about. So you have those general circumstances. From a football perspective, you have many people that see the opportunities that football brings, and that includes, you know, Brother Walfred.
Yes.
There is the obvious things. I mean, long before there's a Celtic, Walfred uses football in different ways. There's simply that boys at his football club, at his school, play football. Yep. There is local teams, so Clyde are used regularly to have, you know, charity games. There's obviously Hibernian in Edinburgh. There's also Dundee Harp. And I think so there is a wide recognition of, one, there's poverty, and two, football is one method that can be used as a means of alleviating that. And that sort of is really brought into particular focus, I think, when Hibs win the Scottish Cup. So in February 1887, Hibs beat Dumbarton, they win the Scottish Cup. And of course, their first port of call, the first place they go to, is not back to Edinburgh, but it's to St Mary's in the Carlton.
Yeah.
And when they come, it's hugely celebrated, not just by the sort of, for want of a better phrase, the Irish elite who are invited to the celebration, but even as the Hibs are coming through the streets, you know, there's notable crowds of people out to celebrate what they see as their club. Because Hibernian do play a symbolic role in sort of Irish integration and Irish identity in Scotland. And I think with all those things, that's what really leads up to eventually a recognition of, wait, numerically, there's more Irish in Glasgow than anywhere else. Proportionally, technically, actually, Dundee was the place that had the highest proportion of Irish born. But even then, just for the concentration, especially in the East End and in similar areas, why would we not have a specific team like this in Glasgow? And it's those conditions that lead to, well, we will. And of course, the 6th of November, 1887 is where it all begins.
And of course, there's also a backdrop to that repeated mention of Catholic, because the dinner tables, the maintenance of the dinner tables, those dinner tables in themselves, they were a charitable. They were obviously filling a need of those who were destitute, but they were also allowing those, and Walfrid, from my knowledge and from what I've read, were very conscious of the fact they didn't want what's now the term take the soup, because there was other religious organisations were offering this kind of succour, this kind of sustenance, but you had to renounce your Catholicism to actually take advantage of those soup kitchens. Therefore, Walfrid was very mindful of the fact that he had to keep his flock within his own religious denomination. So that's the other religious dimension that was also at play in terms of what these dinner tables were and what they were providing. They were providing, yes, the succor of sustenance in terms of like food, but they were also providing almost a kind of spiritual succor in the sense that you didn't have to renounce your own religion. And at the time where Celtic, I've read somewhere that at the time where Celtic came into being, there was more than 100 anti-Catholic societies.
That statistic's quite a funny one, because there's actually, I think it's from earlier than Celtic were formed. It's a little earlier in the 1800s. But at one point, there was almost certainly more anti-Catholic societies in Glasgow than there was Catholics. So you have this really bizarre and strange, bizarre and strange notion. I think almost the easiest way to talk about this is to almost look at each of the things, look at each of the aspects. So look at the charitable aspect, look at the religious aspect, look at the political dimension, and consider, well, what is the sort of evidence for each, or what's the rationale that lies behind each? And I think, I sometimes refer to this as one of the problems of history is that you can get the Disney version of history. It's a little bit like, I don't know how many people have read it, but if you read the original Grimm Brothers fairy tales, and then if you watch the Disney movies, you would think that you were reading just two utterly separate stories, because they are just so different. And obviously the original Grimm Brothers are much darker. And I think with Celtic, there is definitely that aspect that sometimes we can be quite superficial. We just have this idea, Brother Walfrid had a dream. He wanted to feed the poor children, and everybody was happy and everything was great after that. And that's not completely wrong. I think there is genuinely, there's no question that given Walfrid's own history, his own personal history of growing up in the midst of famine, of being forced to leave, age 15, I think we take for granted in many ways, and it wasn't unusual what Walfrid did, but we take for granted just how substantial it was. Walfrid, age 15, gets on a boat with one friend from home and comes to Glasgow. Now, nowadays, there's two things. One, would you let your 15-year-old son just leave home, go to a different country, and all the rest of it? And that's in a world where they could keep in touch quite easily. I mean, nowadays, even if you let them do that, they could literally be on the phone. You could see them physically, on the phone. Whereas this was an element of, off you go.
And will we ever see you again?
Will we ever see you again? What's actually going to happen? And I say that was far from, that was far from an unusual story. So Walfrid himself is clearly very well aware. He's also someone who is clearly very committed to the educational side of it. And I don't think there's any doubts, but the from a charity perspective, there are two principal purposes that lie behind the Poor Children's Dinner Table. The first and most obvious one is, of course, just feeding people. The first one is giving children some food, some sustenance that will sort of see them through the day. But there's also strongly connected to that, there's an educational aspect, because it's obviously very, very difficult, A, to get young people to come to school, and B, to get them to concentrate in school. If you're starving, the last thing you're doing is really sitting, concentrating on, you know, maths or English, geography, history, whatever in those days you would have been studying. So I think there's definitely an element that Walfrid sees this as, I want to feed the children. He also sees, you know, if my job is to educate, then actually I have to ensure that the children are in the best possible condition, that they can be educated. And that is obviously where, you know, the food comes in. And like I say, it's not simply the religious aspect. It's not simply the Celtic and Poor Children's Dinner Table. There's also the aspect you can look at. There are various other charitable things going on in Glasgow at this time, some of which are Catholic specific, some of which are more generic. So I don't think there's any question that at the forefront of, you know, in the top two, as it were, and I think it is the first. I do genuinely think it's the top one. I do think it's the principal driving factor, certainly in the club's initial foundation. How long that maybe lasts before it begins to shift is perhaps what then brings in other aspects of potential influence as well.
But he was also canny enough. You think about the kind of A team they assembled, you know, the most prominent Catholic lay people in that area. And he clearly knew these people. He knew what their motivations might be and the way that they attacked it. I mean, they were pretty ruthless. They weren't just seeing it as like, right, let's make a Celtic that might have people come to see them. They might get good crowds or whatever. They might make some money. They wanted a Celtic that would be a beacon. It would be a symbol of their community. Like, more so, I think, like, again, you might disagree with me, but someone like John Glass, you know, he wasn't playing at it for, it wasn't how the motivations, the charitable motivations with some of those early committee men, you could question. They wanted to kind of put a stake in the ground in Scotland and say, we're here and we're your equal. And, you know, we will put a football club there that all others will have to defer to. Even the famous line about when they lose the 1888,
let them scoff and jeer.
Excuse me? Yeah.
Let them scoff and jeer. Celtic will yet win to the pinnacle of Scottish football, and those that have jeered us today will be forced to cheer. But yeah, that was after we lost to Cowlairs. That was the Exhibition Cup of 1888. Yes. And that was John Glass's famous prediction. And it has to be said, in a literal sense, by the end of that season, we'd beaten Cowlairs 8-1 and 6-1 in the other two cups we played them in. So we had a literal bit of revenge on the actual people he was talking about. But you can argue that in the longer term, we certainly had, you know, a much more substantial sort of form of revenge, as it were. And I think you're right. I think that's what takes us in. As I say, if we accept the premise that the spark, as it were, that brings Celtic into life is an anti-poverty drive. I don't think there's any question that, you know, the religious thing or the identity, the Irish identity aspect, on its own wouldn't have perhaps been enough. You know, if all they'd said was, for example, we're just starting up a football team with no charitable aspect, I suspect the club wouldn't have been as successful. And I think you wouldn't have got the same number of people and the same type of people involved. So I think, if we accept the premise that poverty is the spark, or the need to tackle poverty is the spark, then it then brings in, as you say, what do people like John Glass and so on want? And not simply John Glass, obviously Brother Walfrid. Obviously, I mean, Archbishop Eyre, sorry, is an interesting one, because he's the club's, you know, patron, the club's first patron. Now, Archbishop Eyre is Catholic, but he's not an Irish Catholic. He's not from an Irish Catholic. He's from a very, very strong English Catholic family. You know, his family had been recusants in the past when Catholicism was under threat, you know, was outlawed effectively.
Yes.
In fact, his family had lost land as a consequence, you know, like by sticking to their faith, you know, they'd actually genuinely suffered. And so I think when you've got that context, with the greatest respect, you know, Archbishop Eyre did not sign up to be Celtic's patron because he wanted to see home rule for Ireland or anything along those lines. You know, I'm sure there was obviously a poverty aspect. Archbishop Eyre was also probably the most prominent other East End charity he would be involved in would be the White Veil Children's Home. Which many of the prominent Celtic founders, you know, were also a key part of as well. So I think there's clearly the charitable aspect, but Archbishop Eyre would have seen exactly as you've said. There would have been a concern that, well, are our flock disappearing? Are they being driven towards other outlets? You know, whether it's just because of anger against the poverty they face, whether it's because they're being forced to, and so on. And so I think when you look at, you know, as I say, people like that, you can straight away see the religious dynamic. And as I said to you, when I read the founding quote, you mentioned it yourself, you know, there's no mention at all of Ireland. You know, there's no point at which they say,
no,
this is a means of there. Now, again, that isn't to say that some people didn't have that in their heads, because I think they did to some extent. But there's no question that if poverty is the spark that brings Celtic to life, the initial, the very, very initial drive is Catholicism, and the need to either promote or at the very least defend the faith. And I think there's no question that's a major part of life as well.
And we talk about how they set about doing that. They obviously had it in their minds that they'd seen there'd been other kind of Irish Catholic, in inverted commas, clubs that had risen and fallen because they couldn't quite kind of get that kindling going. So they set about it in the most, as I say, said before, ruthless fashion by poaching what was called later on, like by plenty of Celtic supporters online, you know, improperly registered players, wasn't it? Like,
I think that's a bit overdone. I'll explain why, and I know a couple of Hibs.
But better explain the fact that there was a poaching of six of Hibs players.
There was a massive number of Hibs players. Hibs players in itself is misleading. I think this is the problem. There was a substantial number of players who had played for Hibs, who end up coming to Celtic. Now, this in itself, there's various aspects to this, you know, it's the proverbial, you know, you open a can of worms and, you know, just they go everywhere. And I think that's what happened. I think there's an issue that, one of the issues is simply this. In those days, we don't have professional football. You can't really be tied to a club in a way that we would now understand with contracts. You know, officially, you can't be professional in Scotland and thus under contract until 1893. So 1893 is when that comes in. So it's a few years after.
And Celtic are the drivers of that.
Oh, we're absolutely one of the big John drivers of that. So I think there's an element of that. I think there's also, I don't know, you can argue there's a certain selectivity amongst, you know, Hibs fans that might cite this, because yes, absolutely, Celtic took a number of players from Hibs. There's no question about that. I could, for example, say, well, what about poor Crombery Eglinton? Now, you're going to go, who's Crombery Eglinton? Now, Crombery Eglinton were one of the sort of main low-level teams in Ayrshire. You know, they were one of the sort of bigger Ayrshire teams, perhaps, of the time. Not quite at a Kilmarnock level, but, you know, substantial. Now, many of Hibs' early team, you know, your Mick McEwans, your James McGee's, your Jim McLaren's, who all come to Celtic as well, but they first of all left Crombery to go to Hibs. Now, there's maybe an element where it's a bit selective to go, well, we're going to take players from Crombery. That's absolutely fine. But Celtic are taking it from us. Well, that's absolutely terrible. That's just not right. So there's an element where that's a bit selective. And look, I've got multiple football books. I've got quite a few Hibs history books. I really like them. There's some really, really good Hibs books, which are actually great just to understand not just Hibs story, but the sort of the general sort of the context of the Irish in Scotland, including the rise of Celtic. But I do think there's a certain bit that's different. And the principal difference, which again, which maybe undermines the Catholic aspect of Celtic to the same extent as Hibs, is the fact that unlike Hibs, it wasn't mandatory to be a Catholic.
Yeah.
Whereas for Hibs, you had to be a practicing Catholic. You had to be a member of the Catholic Young Men's Association. You had to be a mass attender. And although perhaps inevitably the early Celtic teams are dominated by principally, well, certainly Catholics, mainly the descendants of Irish, in some cases actually Irish-born players. More commonly, it was sort of second or even third generation Irish.
Yes.
But the reality is that was not a line we went down. And that was a line of controversy. That wasn't that we just didn't think of it. There were absolutely people involved, including at the start of Celtic, who didn't want that, who wanted us to have more of a much more a distinct, you can only be a Celtic player if you're Catholic. And within a year or so, we have non-Catholic players, and it's never clearly been an issue since. Yeah.
They tried to introduce a three non-Catholic rule, didn't they, later within the first decade, but that was voted down at one of the committee meetings from memory.
There was different steps. The most obvious step that was taken to try and force Celtic to more of an Irish Catholic identity, and perhaps in fairness, more of a charitable one. But within a year of Celtic being playing the first game anyway, so 1889, we have a rival club set up. You know, we have Glasgow Hibernian that are established. And Glasgow Hibs were set up, it wasn't really widely known, but you know, many of the people who were involved in the establishment of Glasgow Hibs, most notably a man called James Quillen, were actually very heavily involved, you know, in the foundation of Celtic. The initial step had been, they actually tried to persuade Edinburgh Hibs to move to Glasgow. And then when Edinburgh Hibs said no, they set up Glasgow Hibs. And that was done for the reason that they believed Celtic were not doing enough to promote the Irish Catholic or indeed charitable side of things.
It's interesting. This quote is interesting because choosing the name Celtic, really, we should say, rather than Celtic, but over the mist of time, it just became a soft C rather than the hard C. But when Celtic came on the scene, the Hibernian secretary, John McFadden, said in the Scottish Empire newspaper, "Patriotic Irishmen, truly, the Celtic and its supporters, patriotic Irishmen indeed, who, in order to raise the name of Celts, a name which may cover Welsh, Highland, Scotch, French, and all the nations of the family, dealt as they thought and by which are apparent to everyone a death blow to the Hibernian club." So he's taking issue with what's happened because of the kind of player exodus, but he's also taking issue with the fact that Celtic aren't Irish enough.
I think that's what we'll see the rise, because he clearly wasn't alone in believing that. There were absolutely some people in Glasgow wanted to see more of an Edinburgh Hibs style club, and that wasn't. Now you can get cynical in this. You can say that was for positive reasons, that we believed that, you know, that wasn't the way that we wanted the club to be seen, that we wanted, you know, if we see Celtic partly as a means of integration within to society, then you can see that's partly what lay behind it. There's also the more cynical aspect, perhaps, that we recognise that limiting yourself in that way either costs you better players or it costs you financial, success in terms of attracting people. So you can interpret these things in different ways. But there's no question that from a very early stage, the club, again, this is what I go back to, but, you know, if poverty is the spark and if Catholicism is the sort of thing that pushes it, whether everyone involved in the club wanted that to be the long-term sort of position of the club is, I think, a bit less clear and a bit less likely, to be honest.
So, to be honest, I'm not saying they were cynical, but these guys were in it to win it. That's what I think about that first committee. It was like, it was pragmatism, really. That you know, they said, we want to have a full pool of players. We don't want anybody cut off because we want to be successful. They'd obviously seen the rise and fall of other clubs, and Rangers were struggling to survive, you know, across their first 15 years. You know, there was plenty of times where they nearly went under, and they were determined that they were going to show how they knew where the wind was blowing. They knew how to make a successful football club. And you kind of see that with John Glass, no Celtic. You know, the way that, again, there were certain inducements at play. They were recruiting people that were amateur players, but there were certain jobs or whatever that came along with it. I'm not saying that wasn't prevalent across football, but they also understood that it wasn't going to hold. The old amateur status wasn't going to hold. I mean, these, as much as Walfred himself was a visionary, so was like John Glass, so was even McLaughlin, whether you like him or not, because of the way he was so kind of...
I actually think that, right, I know this is slightly sacrilege, clearly Walfred is always going to be the iconic Celtic figure from a foundation perspective. And he was clearly a major, major, you know, he is very much the figurehead. I think there's an argument that John Glass is probably more important in actually driving the club. I think, you know, if John Glass had come up with an idea to set up a club and hadn't had Walfred, I think that club might have done more than if Walfred had come up with an idea and hadn't had John Glass.
Again,
you can slightly argue that, but I think the reality is, it's a little bit like we said at the start of this, I think the actual truth is that you need both of them, that you can't separate them. I actually think at least John Glass is just as important as Walfred in terms of, you know, developing and taking Celtic forward.
And that's probably where the political dimension comes in. People, John Glass for the kind of the ultras who want to really push the kind of notion that Celtic, you know, like whether kind of for the glory of the kind of Irish home rule and whatever, John Glass has to do an awful lot of heavy lifting for them. I don't know if you agree with me or not.
I think there's more evidence than that. I think, in fairness, I mean, if you were looking at the political dimension, there's no doubt somebody like John Glass who's obviously very involved in, you know, many of the home rule activities that go on in Glasgow, as are other parts of the Celtic Committee. I don't think there's any doubts that Glass realises that just as Hibs, you know, I think it's that symbolic thing. Hibs come, you know, after winning the Scottish Cup to Glasgow's East End, and they're feted by the local people. So if you can have your own Hibs equivalent or even bigger, then that is naturally going to sort of draw people to you. And if you draw people to you in that sense, that may well sort of escalate support for home rule. When we won, as I say, the first trophy that we mentioned, but when we win our first trophy, so May 1889, and we win the North Eastern Cup, my favourite quote, because it's just quite funny, especially because of the area that refers to it, is, but the Scottish Referee, that was one of the main sports newspapers at the time, has a quote that says, "Irish Brigton could not have celebrated more on Saturday night if, you know, Ireland had been granted home rule." And it's, given the stereotypes of Brigton in itself, it's quite funny.
Exactly. But
it does say to that, it does tie in that aspect, though, that, you know, there is a certain recognition that when you talk about Celtic and when you talk about Irishness, that never far away from that in that era politically is discussions of home rule. And clearly people would look and see, well, you know, from a symbolic sense, if we as a community, an Irish community, are strong and visible, shown in, you know, sporting success, then that will bring about, you know, like greater support. Although on a totally cynical thing, you could also point out it was playing the English sport of football. You know, let's bear in mind, you know, that like large parts of Ireland, for example, you can't necessarily play football. You know, historically, look at issues about playing football. You know, at Gaelic football grounds. So I think there's that element of, there's a strange dynamic in the sense that we chose a sport that, for some people at least, was seen as almost not Irish, and we chose that to make
a garrison game, as they would say, in some parts of Ireland.
I think so, absolutely. But then I think if you look at some of the early people who are involved in it, the club does early on bring in a great deal of people and organisations that are undeniably political. I mean, the most obvious one is, of course, Michael Davitt.
Yes.
So, you know, we have early founder, quite famously, you know, plants the first sort of, you know, Irish shamrocks at the new Celtic Park. Somebody digs it up that night and steals it.
But
Michael Davitt is, of course, you know, a former Fenian. He'd been in prison. There's no question that by bringing Davitt in relatively early on in the club's history, you are pushing an agenda of sorts, towards a lot of the, and it wasn't just him. There's lots of stories in that time of various MPs, people like John Redmond and so on, coming to Celtic Park to watch Celtic. There's groups like the Irish Foresters, you know, who were a sort of nationalist group, being invited, you know, coming, doing a whole march from the town, bringing their music and playing it during the game as well. So whether it was, again, I'm not convinced it was the sort of the very, very original goal of the club, but I think very, very soon after that, it becomes much more manifest with the people that are involved, the organisations and different aspects like that.
Well, they start to wield power, don't they? Because they are such a powerhouse. They Celtic are responsible for the huge uptick in crowds that are associated with the first kind of footballing boom. Within 5 or 6 years, they're posting kind of record receipts for a British football club. So they must see themselves that they do have power, so they can push certain agendas. And we've said before, in terms of like recognising that professionalism had to be embraced. I mean, they're like John McLaughlin's seen as the kind of architect of that, isn't he? Another one of those committee members.
The issue with professionalism and formally paying players was, I mean, Willie Maley wrote in his book later, the story of the Celtic, Willie Maley wrote that he thought that, you know, of all the major clubs in Scotland, except Queen's Park, everyone was secretly paying players. And the thing is, he's absolutely right. There's no question about it. There's a really funny set of stories where the SFA were sort of doing an investigation into, you know, into club records. And obviously, I mean, we joke about the biscuit tin at Celtic Park, but the honest reality was, in these days, there's no official crowds. You know, it's actually, you know, it's really one of the really difficult things. You can read one newspaper that says there was 10,000 at the game and then another that says 15. And really, the journalist is just guessing.
Yeah.
But the reality was that you've got all this money coming in. There's quite easy to siphon some of it off to use for unofficial purposes. But when the SFA carried out this investigation, they sort of asked different clubs for their books. We'd said, so Celtic, again, we're at it quite clearly, but we'd said we couldn't provide it because basically the person that had been keeping the books was in a sanatorium, and so the books were basically, you know, not safe to bring about. Rangers claimed that there had been a fire and that theirs had disappeared, and Hibs, I can't remember the exact number, but basically in the previous 3 years, say Hibs had 4 treasurers, but when they handed in their accounts, they were all in the same handwriting. So, I think, again, that's maybe taken away from some of Hibs' idea that they were this bastion of loveliness that was,
dealt with.
The reality is they all found ways around it. But professionalism had to happen because A, it was inevitable, and B, England had it. And that was what made it inevitable in Scotland, because if you wanted to compete and keep your best players, you had to be able to pay them. And in order to be able to pay them, you have to, at some point, you have to sort of formalise, actually, we're going to, for example, have a league system, because obviously league systems are principally important so that you actually have guaranteed fixtures, as opposed to if you rely, as you do before a league, on friendlies and cup games, then you can get knocked out the first round of each cup and you cannot be able to arrange friendlies and you're done. So I think Celtic, as I say, within, if we take, you know, the issue of charity and Catholic straight away, I think you do, though, begin to get these competing identities of, well, we can use this to promote an Irish identity. Yeah. We can use this at the same time to promote a sort of just a bit a footballing success. We now want to be successful. We're not in this just to raise a wee bit of money to feed a couple of kids. Important though that is. And I suppose, I mean, when I do some of the walking tours that I do, I pose this question. What did matter more? Was it more important that Celtic fed a smaller number of children? Because there is a consequence. You know, if you spend less on the team will not do as well and fewer fans will come along and watch. Is it more important, therefore, to just say, no, we're going to be entirely moral about this. This is purely charity, even if we just play basically friendlies and we don't make very much money? Or is it more important to attract bigger crowds? You can make charitable donations, but you can also enhance the strength and the success of the Irish and Catholic community in Scotland. I'm not convinced there's totally a correct or wrong answer to that.
No. There was inevitability. maybe it didn't have to happen as sharply. I mean, it seems to be the kind of turning their back on the charity is pretty brutal. It happens in very quick order. And perhaps there could have been a softer landing for what Celtic were to become. They obviously had to become professional themselves. Not only was that a professional environment, but they had to adopt a certain professionalism within their corporate, not so much corporate, but within their governance structures. But it seems to be, it's quite arresting how quickly, it's almost when Walfred gets posted down to London, it's almost like, see this as opportunity. He's like, boom, he's gone. He's away, right? Because within a year, he's posted to London. Within a year, the Glasgow Observer are lamenting, almost an obituary for the original Celtic. Quoting here, the thing is a mere business in the hands of publicans and others. Catholic Charities got nothing out of the thousands of pounds passing through the treasurer's hands. Can we not get a club that will carry out the original idea of Brother Walfred? Now, this is 1893.
Yeah.
I think this escapes people that how quickly that it was gone. It was gone entirely. As you say, you could have been making charitable donations, but there wasn't anything. There wasn't a single donation to charity.
Well, no, there was still charitable donations. There was. I think cynically, the reason it stands out, the big thing that happens in the year that Walfred leaves is there is absolutely charitable donations when he leaves, but there's no, to the year he leaves, there's no donation to the Poor Children's Dinner Table.
Sorry,
and that was a very symbolic element of, this club was formed to give money for the Poor Children's Dinner Table. Now Walfred's gone, we're not giving anything. Now, it is worth noting the club did again after that. It wasn't, they actually did make donations to the Poor Children's Dinner Table after that, at different times. And each year, I mean, if you go back through the sort of the annual meetings from that time, they do detail that, you know, the charitable giving that's still given. And it is worth noting, I mean, you can make a case that Celtic, even when Celtic shift away from charity, they still give more than probably most clubs. You know, they are still actually, as far as clubs go, they are still right at the forefront of many charities. Now, you can argue as a percentage of the overall amount, but in a purely numeric sense, they give more, I would say, than the majority of clubs at that time. And that's just in literal donations. And absolutely some donations, you know, they continue to make donations, which you can see, as say, if you go through annual meetings. But there is also other ways that the club provides a lot of charitable support. You know, we would go all over Scotland, we would go all over Britain playing benefit games for, you know, different charities, many of which, it has to be said, were connected to the Catholic Church. Again, that maybe takes us back to a factor. But I mean, even for example, 1895, we basically have a carnival. Celtic basically organise a carnival in the old barracks just off the Gallagher. And that's for basically the Home Rule, the Irish political Home Rule movement. I mean, that's what the funding is for. So, again, it's not so much that Celtic immediately went down the lines of being a private club. I mean, that won't happen until 1897. So from 1897 is when private business. But you're right. There's definitely a percentage shift in charity. And I think symbolically, the year Walfred leaves to not make a donation to the very cause that led to Celtic being formed is either enormously poor public relations, or
Celtic were always good at that. That's like right.
Or is a very, very clear nod of you know, this is the direction we're going. We are now focused on this club partly as a success in itself. I mean, it does bring in. You can argue, for example, we said at the start, and I do genuinely think that those are the three things. But we said at the start, charity, religion, or politics. There is, of course, always the fourth, and a much more controversial one. But did business people see a business opportunity? It's a little bit like, this is very cynical, but Barcelona famously never had a sponsor.
Yeah.
And that was obviously costing them millions and millions of pounds. But you couldn't have a sponsor because it would be outrage. So what did Barcelona do? They made it, they gave it to UNICEF for free. They did a charitable thing. Look, us, we are wonderful. We've got a free, you know, we're not taking money off UNICEF. They are getting all this global publicity. Aren't we lovely? But of course, now you'd started the principle then. Because once the UNICEF time is up, now no one can say we don't want a sponsor.
Qatari Airways or whatever it was.
Now you can bring it in. And, yeah. You know, some, I mean, I'm not saying, because I don't actually genuinely think this is a key thing, but there are people that suggest, well, actually, was there people who went, we could do a big business here, but actually we'll pretend at first it's charity. I genuinely don't believe that.
But, don't think that, but maybe people get seduced by, as I say, Celtic were so enormously successful. They were so enormously successful that I think somebody like McLaughlin thought, oh, let's give this up for a game of sodies, you know, about the whole kind of charity thing. Let's be run properly and let's get our slice of the pie because of what we put into it.
But we can even see that in a modern era. I mean, we can even see where I think you can be seduced, not even necessarily by money specifically, but just prestige and power. And also yes. a certain arrogance. I mean, for example, if you look at the Kellys, in terms of the 1990s, one of the things, no, I absolutely, like, I know that they are at times the sort of the villains of the piece, but for all they clearly weren't right for Celtic, I think they genuinely loved the club. You know, they absolutely had the club.
I've said that in a few big podcasts. I mean, I was there at the time, so I know that they really like lived and breathed Celtic. It was like they wanted Celtic to be successful, but they felt that their birthright was they were part of Celtic being successful.
That's what I think the thing is. When you read Michael Kelly in particular, when you read a lot of his things about, you know, we should have run the club because we were right at the heart. We understood, you know, what the club was. We, you know, birthright, I think, is exactly that. And I think from an early stage, when the club shifts more towards a business thing, I think there's an aspect of that. I think certain people that have been involved in growing the club
yes.
begin to get the idea of, well, only we can understand how to run this club. And that's why, you know, you see various complaints, even before the club goes private.
Oh, yeah.
You see various complaints from fans that they're trying to price them out. So, for example, there's one big fight that happens one year when the club wants to increase the subscription rate you had to pay to be a member of Celtic. And the theory was that this was the sort of the more middle-class members trying to sort of push out the working-class element who wouldn't be able to afford this. And I think when you get to that and then you go to the private club, when you start to actually get shares, at that stage, I think it becomes very clear that a lot of people, whatever the factors that lay behind the club's foundation, now see this as, oh, this is ours. And yeah. we want what's best for it. But really, only we know what's best for it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we see it even half-yearly meeting in December 1894, Tom Maley pointed to the complete absence of any money for the charity associated with the departed Walford. He drew the contrast between a striking income of £7,000 and the complete neglect of good causes. That's obviously Willie Maley's brother.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was recognising it there. And by this time, I suppose we owe it to the Celtic, these committee guys. Celtic had a new stadium, an expensive new stadium. Apparently, they said they were losing money because they were trying to attract the best players and obviously pay for this stadium that the first sod was laid by Michael Davitt. So, in 1892, so that would have eaten up a chunk of any kind of income.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubts that the, you know, Celtic Park 2, or the modern site for Celtic Park, is a huge drain. You know, an absolutely massive drain. I mean, and by all accounts, you know, when the new Celtic Park opened, you know, it was genuinely a standout venue. You know, there's all sorts of news stories from journalists from different parts of, you know, who've been at different parts of Europe saying, you know, there's nothing like this anywhere else in Europe. You know, this is really an amazing ground. And as you say, that comes at a cost, and so does it come at a cost with the players as well. And even so, before 1893, when you couldn't legally pay, but clearly were, and then afterwards in 1893, once you were, that is the simple reality. The club did have a choice that if you had said, right, we are going to stick entirely to the founding goals and give half our money to charity or whatever, you know, the case is, not that they ever actually gave as much as half, but, you know, even if you'd said, right, we are going to say 25% of all club money is put aside, you could absolutely do that. But 25%, for example, of average crowds of 1,000 is a lot less than 5% of crowds of 10,000, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
Because that would have been a choice. The simple reality, as you've mentioned it a lot, but Irish clubs are 10 a penny in these days. A new Irish club getting set up is really not all that newsworthy. There were countless Erins and Shamrocks and Emmets and Hibs and eventually Celtics to be found in Scotland. And some of them are rarely fleeting, like months or a couple of years at a time. Some of them a little bit longer. But many of them, Dundee Heart were one of the really big sides in that era. And they will eventually disappear. Hibs, if you want to be really cynical, you could argue that the current Hibs are a newco, a bit
Exactly.
like other ones. So,
I have argued to Celtic supporters that don't want to know,
we have absolutely. I think we are aware of that there is this problem of, on the one hand, it sounds great to say, let's give much more money to charity, and that's very valid. But that would have come at a cost. And it takes us back to that question of what was more important? Is it more important that Celtic stand out as a symbol of, the integration and success and confidence of Irish and Catholics in Scotland with bigger crowds but less to charity? Or is it more important that we give percentage-wise a bigger amount to charity, but it'll be a smaller amount overall, and we just become Clyde, for
And
example?
these tensions really begin to play, don't they? These kind of the board meetings once we get to kind of 1895, 96, it's really kind of it's
Yeah,
becoming
I
a
think
kind of.
as we do the run up to will Celtic become a private company, I think because I think there's
When
no
do you
question.
think that kind of
Yeah.
first kind of?
If you're one of the people that thinks we don't do enough for charity and so on, and you see that we are about to become a private business, then it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out that if a non-private company, if a member-owned company is giving a what you think is too little money to charitable support, then a private company is absolutely not going to do more. So yeah, I think that is when you start to get a lot of the arguments. And then obviously say 1897, when it becomes a private business, all bets are off at that point. In
Yeah.
fairness, if I was defending slightly again also the early board or the early committee before we've got a board, there was also an element. One of the reasons, and I think actually Glasgow Hibernian are a part of this, one of the reasons that the board want to become a limited company is they're liable for Celtic's debts. If Celtic, if you're a committee, if you're a sort of member-owned company and you are one of the sort of senior investors and Celtic were to collapse suddenly, it's actually potentially your house that gets taken.
Right.
And for example, in the case of, I mean, I mentioned Glasgow Hibs, but when Glasgow Hibs go bust, that's exactly what happens. I mean, James Quillan, who I said was one of the early Celtic founders, but James Quillan gets taken to court. And I suspect that sort of thing, and that was not unusual. Like in terms of Britain at the whole, there was other instances of football clubs facing, where the people that had run it face financial challenges. And I don't think it's any accident that all across Britain you start to see, and from Celtic especially looking at Glasgow Hibs, I think there's an understanding of, yeah, it's all very well doing the moral thing, but if this was to go bust, actually it's me that's going to be
On
left carrying
the
the can. And so I don't think it's purely cynicism.
No.
I think there's just the self-preservation element.
And there's also the kind of acknowledgement of, and these guys have always been, they've always been on top of the way that the wind's blowing. They've always recognized, they've always could see that the way that football was going, they were pretty kind of visionary in their own ways because they could tell about like the change to from amateurism to professionalism. Even something like John McLaughlin, he was the guy that got the SFA introduced football nets. I mean, these guys were quite they were switched on in so many respects, whether it was business, whether it was with the football environment and the way that was going. He was also, John McLaughlin was also kind of seen as one of the kind of architects of the first kind of Scottish League. He was the guy that brought that in, he been and legalize sorry the legalization of professionalism in 1893. But one of the ones that I always find really stark is by the mid 1890s, we're saying that there's this kind of tension between the people that want to remain the idealists and guys like McLaughlin and other members of the committee who see that there is just an inevitable move towards becoming a limited company. And when he sues this Frank Haviland, who was a club member of the Idealist faction, a labourer, who, because Frank Haviland kept repeating the fact that he described the guys who wanted Celtic to stay as the kind of charitable kind of members organisation as corner boys and loafers, you know, and that he actually didn't win his case, McLaughlin, because the judge said he shouldn't have been, it was a kind of, like he shouldn't have taken that on. But apparently, I mean, he's kind of besmirched because of the kind of elements that this kind of, Pat Woods just really taken against him because of what he did to a fellow supporter or whatever who just saw Celtic differently from him.
I think, yeah, again, as you say, you bring up the, quite rightly, the issue of the tensions which happen. I suppose there's an element that, in the long run, history is written by the winners. It's a little bit like, you know, Fergus McCann. Now, Fergus McCann is now considered this iconic figure in Celtic history, and he's clearly massively important. And he's partly been helped by the collapse of Rangers, because, of course, he's been proven to be right. Everything that he predicted, every step that he took, really was the foundation for where we are today.
Yes.
Now, I say this with the greatest of respect, but I don't think Fergus McCann's a particularly warm or friendly individual. And it's fair to say that when he was at Celtic Park, he was less than popular with both fans and media and so on. And there's that element of he who laughs loudest.
Yes.
And okay, that's what
McCann would have fitted.
Yes, I have to be nice.
Yeah.
You have to be successful. And I think for the likes of McLaughlin, was McLaughlin very, very hard-nosed? Did he have a clear plan? Yes. I don't think there's any question about that. Definitely as a driving force behind the Scottish League. He's principally a driving force behind the Scottish League as well because he wants professionalism. And again, these two things are very, very strongly. I mean, Queen's Park's main reason for opposing and not joining the Scottish League is that they see this as a Trojan horse for professionalism. And they are completely spot on in that analysis. They're absolutely right. And so I don't think there's any doubts that as these people are pushing for certain things, that brings almost a form of collateral damage. But that's the reality. You know, Fergus, we are standing here now. Okay, John McLaughlin's not clearly Brother Walfred's the one that stands out. That's why I think podcasts like this are important. That's why when I do the walking stuff, I always talk about it because, again, there's the need to avoid the Disney version of history. You know,
definitely. I've talked about a lot, the Disneyfication of Celtic's origins. And it's funny when you mentioned Fergus McCann because he would have slotted right in with that first committee.
Absolutely.
He would have slotted right in.
He might have considered them a bit soft.
But then we get to the, and I suppose you can't help but kind of considering that something kind of, we all love idealism, you know, something kind of special passes, you know, when charity ends, 4th of March, 1897, the same St. Mary's Hall where the club had been formed for charity, the noble ideals were kind of, surrender. Well, we weren't used the word surrender. We're sold. I've written sold out in my book, but I don't like sold out. Those noble ideals kind of gave way to history. It was agreement that was reached in the creation of Celtic Football Athletic Company Limited. First meeting on 17th of June that year, John McLaughlin elected chairman. A board comprised of James Kelly, James Grant, John Glass, Michael DeBar, John McKillop, and John O'Hara. But notably, the following year, Celtic set another British record for football income with profits. This is profits for the club that had said the year before, one of the drivers they said for the like going to a public limited company was because they had to play for the concrete for the World Cycling Championships, and which was obviously just a kind of, it was a front for like what they wanted to do anyway. But so there was a new British record was set for football income with profits at £16,267. Now, I wonder how much that would be in this day and age, but that would be a lot of money, would it not?
Well, I mean, you're talking, yeah, big, big profits. And like we say, Celtic are a standout. And I think sometimes we can forget, because obviously English football is within Britain is the dominant aspect now in terms of money, in terms of global profile. But the reality is, in these days, there is much less of a divide. You know, Celtic are, you know, when we go all over Britain playing charity games, we are one of the big draws. I mean, you almost lose count of the number of times that when you read local newspapers from the various places that Celtic went and played in the 1890s across England and so on, of people writing a record crowd for the ground, you know, never so many people lined the ropes as came along. So Celtic were this enormous draw. And as you say, in Scotland as well, we are definitely there at the time when, you know, crowds begin to massively escalate. And that's why, I mean, that's why Celtic Park is built. It's why Ibrox is, you know, it's why Rangers eventually moved to a different Ibrox, because there is this recognition that, well, Celtic are stepping ahead. You know, if you've got the biggest ground, you're going to get the finals. You're going to get the internationals. You know, this is, of course, in the days before there's fixed venues where we play these things. So there's no doubt, as I say, that a lot of Celtic people then saw these business opportunities. Now, again, was there an element of personal enrichment? I suspect there was by the time we get a few years into the club. Was there also simply an aspect of, you know, Irish identity? I think definitely. And was there just in that a sense of personal achievement? I have started a football club. I want it to be the best. It can only be the best if we have money. And therefore, and it's not really any different then from where we are just now in its own sense. You know, look at the club's profits just now. Compared to any other team in Scotland.
And the charity now that the club contributes to the charity foundation, but possibly is one of the biggest contributors is the supporters through their own efforts in terms of the money raising events they have. But what's notable about that, £16,267,000 profit was dividends amounted to 20% of that were paid to directors and shareholders. Nothing was earmarked for charity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a kind of...
Well, once you go down the private...
That's the beginning, the end of the beginning, isn't it, for Celtic?
Once Celtic become a private club, then, as I say, that's all bets are off, you know, at that point. You know, I think any pretense that we are now... You know, there are still certain charitable things that the club does, but, yeah, in terms of that principle, that early aim of we are going to be funded and basically the profits are going to go into poor children's bellies, as it were. Yeah, there's no question that by the time you get to a private company, then that's just gone. And again, that's back to in the early years. The question, I suppose, then is, though, at what point does that change? Was that always a goal? I don't think it was. I say, I do genuinely think poverty connected to religion is the initial driver. Some people then see it as an opportunity, you know, to promote an Irish identity that then becomes a business potential opportunity. And there's also just the achievement. You know, if we're in some ways, perhaps we're being overly cynical or maybe being unfair on Celtic, because at this time, were Partick Thistle or were Hearts or were Rangers or were, you know, other clubs like that, were they devoting bulks of their income to charity? And the simple answer is that they weren't. So there is, at this point, football had just become a self-perpetuating monster, as it were, then. And the only way to stay at the top was to pay for that.
And in fairness to a lot of those guys, they devoted 10 years of their life to making Celtic become the behemoth of Scottish football. And in the decade and a half that followed, people would say that under Mailey and his six in a row and such like, they were the best team in the world. It's always very hard to quantify that, but certainly they were one of the real powerhouses across world football. So they would say, as you've said before, they would say, we're vindicated. Look where Celtic, look the kind of trajectory that Celtic...
Absolutely. And look at the pride it brought. And I mean, I would argue, I mean, all across Britain, I think there's a case, maybe this does bring the political aspect. I think the interesting thing is that in many ways, again, because football wasn't necessarily seen as an Irish sport specifically, especially in what becomes the Republic. Obviously, the Republic doesn't exist at that point in time. But if you look at, you know, whenever we go anywhere in Britain, the reason the big crowds are coming out is I think Celtic are the Irish club.
Yes.
Celtic are the principal Irish club within Britain. In a footballing sense,
they still are in a lot of ways. They're seen as a kind of de facto. They're seen as a kind of de facto because there isn't a real major football club within the island of Ireland. So they're seen, well, certainly the kind of, in terms of the South, they're seen as the kind of South's kind of representatives almost.
I think there's definitely an element of that. I mean, obviously English football is more popular, and you only have to walk around Dublin, you know, you're more likely to see Man City, Man United are there. But I think if people were to sort of name, especially in this era, you know, who's the sort of the best Irish club in Scotland? Well, that's what Celtic were. And that's what they were written about as in all the newspapers, you know, quite regularly just referred to as the Irish club, you know, the representatives of Hibernia and all that different type of thing. So, and again, that's it. But again, that it brings us all back together. I think the simple, you know, we started this podcast talking about why does Celtic's foundation come about? And I think the problem is there's not really a singular point. I think if you look at the club's conception,
you're quite happy. Let's end it with you've got a top three. You've clearly got a top three. I think it's my top three as well. But you're the best, Matthew.
Poverty is absolutely
number three.
If I was doing it in reverse order, politics is the third. There's no question about it. It's there. It would be wrong to deny that to suggest it wasn't there. But it's absolutely not at the very very start. The driving factor. It will, I think, within a couple of years become much more prominent, come at the forefront, but initially it's absolutely not. And maybe that's partly a success thing. It's once the club becomes successful that people really see, well, there's a big opportunity to do something more than just the other two things. For many of the people, I think number two is the Catholic aspect. Again, you only have to read the founding quote to see that, you know, that's what they keep talking about. You only have to see, you know, Archbishop Eyre and people like that are involved because they believe there's an element of defending the faith. But the first one, I think, the absolute catalyst is the charitable thing. The only question is how long that lasts, but that's a separate question.
Well, that's been an absolute pleasure, Matthew. Thank you so much, and thank you for articulating that so with such clarity and such knowledge. Really appreciate it.
Always great to talk about these things.
Oh, brilliant. No, we should do a plug for your walking tours. When's the next walking tour?
Yeah, the walking tours are, they are finished for this calendar year.
Right.
I had a walking tour just at the weekend before the semi-final, Southside one. So I do various tours around Glasgow, City Centre, Southside, match day one, going to the pub and so on. So there's various ones. But yeah, I've got a website, which is Celtic Walking Tours. wordpress.com, or right, if you go into my Twitter page, which is at Hail Hail History, you can see the link. I do probably about one a month across the year on average, but I don't do it in the more winter months because of, you know, Scottish weather. So
makes sense. So you'll be back about May.
There's a 1 week window in July where you can do it, but the walks will start again about next, probably March. Although I did actually do one on the 2nd of January last year, and the weather was beautiful, so I might change my mind. But in theory, it'll be about March, so people are welcome to look. But yeah, the walks are free to attend. Maybe going back to sort of Celtic's origin, the only thing I say is if you're coming, look, you're welcome to make a charity donation. But I'm certainly not looking for money, and people are very welcome therefore to come along. But it's a great way to find out, great way to meet other Celtic fans, do a walk, and also, you know, learn a little bit more about particularly the club's early history.
Well, I've learned plenty tonight, and I thank you very much for that. And more power to your elbow where the walks, and more and look forward to many more of your pods for our Celtic Underground site.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again much for having me.
Thanks very much, Matthew.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
We hope you enjoyed that podcast. There will be more along soon. Please share the joy of Celtic Underground. Rate us wherever you can find us on your podcast provision, and also subscribe to the CelticUnderground.substack.com. As you'll be aware, there are two types of subscription. There's free subscription, where you get a certain amount of content delivered directly to your email address. And then there's a paid-for subscription, where you get even more content delivered directly to your email address as and when it comes out. Anyway, enough of me. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. laughter. All the while, in this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.